This week on What's Going On with Earl Ingram, we feature an English teacher from Milwaukee Public Schools, a mediator, a semi-retired lawyer, and a father of four, Charles Robinson, known for his energy, resilience, and strong sense of justice. He focuses on improving his neighborhood. His volunteer role includes civic engagement coordinator for the NAACP and secretary of Borchard Field Cares. He also serves on the Milwaukee Homicide Review Commission and the Milwaukee Police Use of Force Subcommittee. Let's get into it. Don't miss it. Airing this week on all streaming platforms. Follow us on civicmedia.us or wherever you follow your podcast. Please like and subscribe as well.
Right. You know, I'm so thrilled to have the opportunity to do these podcasts. And so what's going on, Earl Ingram, is as rewarding as anything that I've done in media realm. And because it gives me an opportunity to bring people like my guests that we have today in the studio and to really give people an idea of people who we may never get to know, but who do tremendous work in the volunteer community and whose lives have been enriched. And my guest today is a man who's worn many different hats. He's certainly well-educated. He's done so much with his life. And, you know, when you look at a guy like my guest today, and he squeezed all of this into one life, you sometimes wonder how people can have the same lifespan and not have accomplished anything. But it's with that backdrop that I'd like to introduce to you, Mr. Charles L. Robinson. Good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
Good morning, man. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share myself.
You know, man, you are such a, you know, effervescent person who has really kind of been like a heartbeat in the city of Milwaukee. It's great to finally get a chance to have you in front of a microphone. Man, you know, it's your accomplishments are too numerous to even go through completely during the time we're going to be doing this. But let's talk a little bit about who Charles L. Robinson is, your background, where you came from, and then we can get into all the nuts and bolts of all the other things.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been in Milwaukee for most of my life. I joined my mother when I was about 3 and a half, going on 4 years old. She came up with the Great Migration of Black people who fled the South and Jim Crow to find a better life for themselves. And she left me when I was 2 years old with my grandparents. They were great caregivers, surrogate parents. And so I still consider myself a country boy, you know, growing up in Northeast Louisiana, East Carroll Parish.
Do you remember anything about it?
On
you
a farm.
Man.
Oh, I remember so much. I actually can go all the way back to 2 and a half years old when I developed this this mindset of violence prevention, because I had two cousins, they're slightly older, and I remember somebody had wet the bed or something, and my grandmother had her leather strap, and she was getting ready to whoop somebody. I was laying in the bed and I couldn't stop her. Normally a toddler, when a toddler cries or something, everybody, you know,
right,
will stop and check. But I didn't have the power. I felt powerless to stop them from getting a whooping. And they were crying and begging for mercy and everything. And that was a moment where something changed in me. And from then on, I just couldn't stand to see people cry.
So we're going to get into all of that. but your journey in the city of Milwaukee, let's talk a little bit about that, because it shaped who you are. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, before I left the South, you know, the farm with my grandparents, my grandmother, she was like God. You know, she made her own medicine. You know, she was like a witch doctor and a shaman, but very, very spiritual. And she told me when I was 3 and a half, she said, the Lord has work for you. And all of my life, I was wondering, what does she mean by that? And so for most of my life, you know, I'm wondering, is this it? You know, at first I thought they wanted me to preach. You know, I didn't want to be a minister. I didn't want to preach. But I found a ministry in conflict resolution, in peacemaking. And so that's what I'm doing now. Actually, I'm trying to create a network.
So you're jumping so far ahead. I want to talk about your childhood.
Yeah.
In the city of Milwaukee, and because people who are listening now have no concept of how beautiful our childhood was in the city of Milwaukee in the 50s and the 60s.
Well, you know, mine didn't start out beautiful because my mother was very young. You know, when she moved here, she was like 19 or 20 years old. She was very young. She was a teenage mom. I remember having to help her fight her jealous boyfriends and stuff. And then she married my stepfather, who he had a drinking problem. And, you know, he was kind of like manic depressant.
Right.
And I faced a life and death situation with him about 5 times. Up until I moved, you know, I went to college.
But did you have siblings?
I was the oldest of 9.
Wow.
And the next one is 8 years younger. My sister Yvonne. And I was about, on my 21st birthday, she gave me a birthday card that said, to my fatherly, friendly brother.
So 9.
Yeah, I was older than 9.
What a small family. I'm from a family of 13.
Oh, well, I knew your brother. I knew Lester.
So you here you are, and the oldest, right?
Yeah.
So a burden and a responsibility as the oldest child.
I was the third parent.
Yes.
A lot of babysitting, changing diapers, feeding babies, you know.
So that responsibility that the oldest child has in helping to, you know, make sure that his siblings are safe and all those kinds of things. You're the oldest person, and you said 8 years in between. So you really had to take on a monstrous responsibility as a young boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. And my sister, who's 8 years younger, plays every brass instrument in the orchestra, right? And she was a music teacher for MPS before she retired. They're living in Arizona right now. But she went so far in music because I was denied because right. I went to summer school. And the band director at Robert Fulton said I couldn't be in the band because I was a 7A. You may remember
that. Yeah, 7A, 7B.
Yeah, the mid-semester graduate. And he said, if I hadn't gone to summer school, I would have been in the band. But we couldn't afford an instrument.
So if we don't look solely at your own personal life, but we look at the city that you grew up in, being Milwaukee at that point in time, how did you find Milwaukee?
Milwaukee was under socialism. You know, the mayor was a socialist.
Frank Zeidler,
exactly, and his brother before him was socialist. Right. And we had social centers. Every playground had playground coaches, and in fact, that's how I learned how to play chess and a lot of things off the playground because we lived right across the street from the playground. So I was at the playground as often as possible. I was babysitting a lot and taking care of children. But when I got a chance to play, you know, I was.
The reason I brought this up is because you look at Milwaukee today, mm-hmm. and when I grew up in Milwaukee, the community was safe. It was a robust community. There was businesses, there clearly were churches. It was a neighborhood, right?
Exactly. I remember when I was in junior high school, I was a paper boy, you know, morning sentinel.
Sentinel, right? I was a journal guy.
Man, anyway, I was getting up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. I have three sons, and they're all 6'3", 6'4", right? Okay. And people were wondering, well, why are you so short? I said, I stunt my growth because you grow when you sleep, right?
Right, right.
I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning before I went to school. And but, you know, those were some challenging times as well. And but I'm so glad I had the what I was about to say is Miss Washington, the music teacher in junior high school, put an ad in the paper for someone to do landscaping for her yard. I answered the ad. I got hired, and she lived over on like 16th and Keep, right?
Oh yeah, well, she was in the suburbs.
Yeah, 16th
back
and Keep.
Then.
And we were on 9th and Ring.
Yeah,
it was that kind of relationship that we had with professional people. I remember the first black coach, Bob Harris, would walk to school at Fifth Street School. He would walk on his way to school past our house every day, and I would watch him. And he was so well dressed. He was kind of like you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know so much about that other than I know Bob Harris, and who from those dates and times did not know Bob Harris. Bob Harris was a man who they really should erect a statue to.
He was an undefeated welterweight champion in the Army.
Well, and you know, he impacted the lives of thousands and thousands and thousands of young men. And, you know, Bob Harris passed, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
And when he passed, you know, people just remembered, man, the greatness of one man. And it goes to show what you can do with your life.
Well, there were two black male teachers at Fifth Street School. Grant Gordon was one. I had Grant Gordon, but Bob Harris was the other. And
so you're actually talking about the late 1950s.
52, 53.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that was amazing in itself that there were any black teachers because of what we were dealing with the civil rights struggles.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and Milwaukee being what Milwaukee was at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As far as segregation and those kind of things. But let me ask you.
Yeah.
You got through all those things. You graduated from high school. You went on to college. What was the first thing that you, specialized in?
Well, let me go back on with Bob Harris. I wanted to play for Bob Harris. Right, I was a quarterback, and they built Highway 43,
right,
which just put me in Rufus King's area, so I ended up going to Rufus King High School,
a very well respected academic school then as well as it is today.
They still got the prescription,
right?
It's an international blue ribbon international baccalaureate high school right now, and when we were there, the Washington, D.C. came out to find out why we were so, we were tops in music. We were tops in sports, academics. We had the best choir. You know, we had a lot of things going for ourselves. So, and then we had all of the languages, you know. So I had a classic education, high school education at Rufus King. I was overprepared when I went to college because I didn't have any study habits. I didn't have to study. Right.
Well, that kind of still exists today with Rufus King. It is a baccalaureate school and right in the heart of the black community. When you look around, many of the schools around it don't have that success story. As a matter of fact, they're struggling, and unfortunately, many young people aren't being educated. So.
That's right.
Rufus King is that oasis.
We had a chemical lab. We had college chemistry in high school, physics. You know, I had Latin. I thought I wanted to be a doctor until I realized I didn't like. I couldn't stand the sight of blood, right? And my mother, when she was pregnant, I couldn't look at her. I couldn't stand to look at her. So I said, maybe I shouldn't go into medicine.
Right.
So I found my ended up going to Whitewater. Because I didn't want to be too far from home because of the domestic violence.
Right.
But I had a chance to go to Dartmouth. They were sending me a lot of, I didn't realize they were trying to recruit me, but they were.
So let's now talk about what happened after college. What did you wind up doing?
Oh man, you know, I was charged with two felonies and a misdemeanor when I was at Whitewater my junior year.
Yeah, well,
and I was the only black athlete on the football team for 3 years straight, and then we had a riot on campus, and I was completely innocent of all of those charges.
But you weren't the only one. The Oshkosh and...
Oh, Oshkosh, they kicked out everybody.
Well, Platteville. And so that was the order of the day.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about a time, you know, where civil unrest in Wisconsin being what it was and is in many instances, segregated.
Right.
And blacks going to those universities for the first time.
Those were turbulent times.
Right.
In the 60s.
Well, and because it was also nationally, it was a turbulent time.
Exactly.
And so you guys were born at a time of change.
Right.
And that was taking place, and there were people who weren't so excited about the change.
You know, when I went to Whitewater, there were only maybe, it was under 50, at the most 50 black students on campus. Now I believe there's 500.
Right.
And all of the fraternities are represented there, and sororities are represented, the black sororities and fraternities there. But we started Alpha Phi Alpha, the chapter that we started in 1968. And we had our own frat house. We had our own house after 1 year. Go ahead.
So after, you know, you graduated, what was the discipline you chose?
I chose education. I had a double major. And then December 16th, 1969 is when they had this, it was like a mini riot.
Yes.
The brothers were.
Well, Dr. King was assassinated in 68.
Oh, it was a lot of things.
Yeah. On. And, you know, Robert F. Kennedy and Vietnam War.
That was the background.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Of what we were dealing with, because they had closed housing in Whitewater, the town. So if you were married, like in graduate school, you couldn't even get an apartment.
So it was a sundown city, right?
Yeah.
Or if it wasn't, those cities around it was sundown.
It was a sundown town.
Right.
It was a sundown town. And
which meant what for people who are listening who don't know?
Well, we had skirmishes. I remember one night we were at the pizza place, Red Lantern Pizza Hut, pizza place, restaurant. I normally didn't go out and socialize very much because, you know, I was an athlete,
right?
You know, college athlete, like weight games and stuff, and I was trying to. I had like a 3.6 average going at that time.
Right.
And some brothers knocked at the door, said, man, you don't never go out with us. Come on. Come on. And they talked me in, a guy named Roland Buck. You probably know
him. Yeah, I know Roland Buck.
And so they talked me into going to Red. On the way to Red Lantern, a car drives past, and they yelled out, again, right? Well, they used the N-word.
Right.
I shouldn't say it on radio. But I tried to catch the car because I wanted to see who said that?
Right.
Because these are the same people who will be in the stands. Go, Charlie, go.
Right, right.
Go, Charlie, go. But so we ended up at Red Lantern. In comes, we're at the table. The waitress is taking our order. In walks about four or five football players. Well, it was at least one football player,
right,
and his buddies. And the football
Your
player.
Your teammates.
Yeah, I ain't gonna mention his name.
Right,
he was an All-American tackle, big dude. He comes over and asks the waitress, "Are these guys giving you a hard time?" See, Bucknam had started drinking, so they were about to fight in the restaurant, right? And I broke it up. I said, well, why don't you guys take it outside? Because I'm thinking about the saloon, you know, the cowboy
right.
days. And in the saloon, everything gets
right.
broken and torn up. And somebody got to pay for it, right? So they went on outside. And the gentleman, who I can't mention his name, he ended up in a one-on-one fight with a guy who happened to be a nationally ranked wrestler.
Right. And just an ugly scene.
So yeah. I broke it up, you know. And then when our buddy got off the ground, he started swinging on everybody. And so out there in the parking lot, it was ended up being a free-for-all. But there were a lot of scrimmages like that. And I think a lot of it was just miscommunication.
Well, it was the time. Okay?
It was the time.
It was the time. But so you chose education, and why?
I wanted to coach. I wanted to teach and coach at my alma mater. That was a dream job for me. And when I graduated, took a job at a junior high school, Robert Fulton Junior High School. During my second year, I was offered a coaching position at Rufus King, my alma mater. And I would have been teaching a course in child psychology and English, right? So that was perfect.
Right.
Everything was going perfect. And then the union stepped in and said, well, you can't transfer because you don't have tenure.
Right.
And they wanted to, I think the intention was to keep experienced teachers in the school as long as possible.
Yeah.
And so I only had 2 years and I couldn't accept the position. Young man, I was angry. I was angry and really upset.
So, how long did you remain a teacher and educator?
Well, I left after my second year.
And you were only an educator for 2 years.
Well, I was in the classroom for 2 years.
Right.
Now, after I graduated from law school, I've always been an adjunct professor.
Listen, so that's a big jump from a teacher to law school. How did that happen? When did that happen?
Well, the reason two reasons why I left the classroom in 1972, right, after my second year teaching, one was that union management
right.
situation. The other was there was so much systemic and structural racism going on. And even though I was the first teacher to graduate from Robert Fulton to come back and teach there, for the first time I noticed it was glaring in my face as a teacher. I could see the lack of educational equality
right.
in education opportunity.
But that was in everything back then.
Well, but see, at Robert Fulton, we had the capacity of the building was 900.
Yeah.
We had 1,600 students.
Yeah, well, Fulton was kind of brand new school. It hadn't been around a long time when.
Yeah, it wasn't that old, but I had a chance to go to some of the other schools. I was on the gymnastics team,
right.
And we had competition at a brand new school, that John Marshall.
Right.
And what I noticed was the lighting in John Marshall was like 100 watt. And when I got back to Robert Fulton, it looked like we were in a dungeon.
Yeah.
You know, like stuff like that.
You know, Charles, you became an attorney. I mean, that's more than a notion to go from being an educator to an attorney. How many years did that take?
Well, just 3 years, you know. Lloyd Barbee.
Yeah.
The legendary.
Yes.
Lloyd Barbee, state assemblyman, state Congress. He also had his law practice.
Right.
And he taught. He was adjunct professor at UWM as well. But I met him, and I was so impressed with what he was doing. And when I felt a need to do something about the lack of educational opportunity, because here as a teacher, I could see it.
Right.
And I got involved in school board politics. And I said, well, I'm going to leave the classroom, go get me a law degree and come back and run for school board, right?
So wait a minute.
I never did.
So you're going to get a law degree to run for school board?
I felt I needed to have a law degree because I wanted to be like Lord Barbie.
Right, right. That was a great man to be, to want to pattern yourself after, no question.
Yeah, I want to follow his footsteps.
But there's only one Lloyd Barbie.
There's only one Lloyd Barbie.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, and history will certainly attest to that. Exactly. A lot of attorneys, but they aren't reverenced like Lloyd Barbie.
My second year in law school, he let me.
Where'd you go?
I was in Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I remember Lloyd Barbie. I was kind of hanging out with him during the day. And we were going from meetings and one meeting to another meeting. We never walked anywhere. He was running, almost like a sprint, going from one meeting from the courthouse to his office.
Right.
That man was, like you said, there's only one Lloyd Barbie.
You know, so you became an attorney. How long did you practice?
You know what? I never really practiced.
See, this is a story I'm trying to get to.
Well, listen, my first job out of law school, I was an administrative law judge because the EEOC had, I think it was a four-year backlog.
Equal Employment Opportunity.
Right. They had a four-year backlog, and they hired four of us right out of law school to deal with that backlog. The state agency, Equal Rights Division, is the EEOC's counterpart on the state level, right? And they had a contractual agreement. And so they hired us to work as administrative law judges for the state agency because they had concurrent jurisdiction, so they would share cases, right? And in about 11 months, we had knocked that backlog down to nothing. And then we were on the street.
So after that, you chose not to practice law. What happened then?
Well, I was kind of fed up with Wisconsin. I actually moved to Denver, Heartbreak City. And I was there for a while. I was about to be hired by Martin Marietta. You know, they built the Viking spacecraft that went to the moon. So I was going to be like a contract attorney there. And then, but my daughter had been born. And I wasn't married, but I wanted to do the right thing. I wanted to make sure she was provided for. And I had concerns. So I left Denver, came back to Wisconsin because the state said they wanted to rehire me to work in, not in the equal rights area, but it was another state agency as an administrative law judge. So I got back, interviewed with them, and the guy didn't hire me. He said, well, I only get 1 month to have you on probation because you've already worked for 11 months. So he changed his mind. So I'm back in Wisconsin with, what did I end up doing? Oh, I took a job with the court. I ended up working for the court administrator and the chief judge. Actually, I ended up working for four chief judges and the court administrator, and I ended up being appointed special master. So I used to, behind the scenes, I was kind of running that whole complex.
So when we're talking about, how long did you do that?
I did that for about 3 years.
Okay, so... is there any place that you stayed for an extended period of time in the way of employment?
Great question. I think the longest I have ever stayed anywhere was 4 years.
Really? Really?
Yeah, I ended up taking a job. My emphasis in the law was labor employment law, right? And I wanted to work in labor relations.
A lot of opportunities during that time with industry being here.
Exactly. And I was on the top of the list. But during the interview, the appointing authority was involved illegally, and he had already chosen. He had someone who was about to graduate from Marquette that he wanted to have that position, and he kind of sabotaged my interview. And they knew, I knew enough about labor law, labor relations, so they anticipated I was going to file a lawsuit. So they offered me a position at institutions, county institutions and departments out in Watertown, Plank Road. So I ended up being the fourth step grievance officer.
Go ahead.
I was the fourth step grievance officer there. But they said the job was, it was designated as a temporary appointment, but they said they were going to make it regular, and they never did. So that's why I was only there for like 1 year.
So for the sake of time,
yeah.
What are some of the other distinguishable positions that you've held?
Well, I worked for the city. I worked for under John Norquist. I was equal rights specialist, and in that position, I had a chance to do some things which was kind of unique. You remember the old boys' tech? My daughter was a student there, and nothing in that building worked because it was just old. Harness figure was trying to off. They were trying to contribute some infrastructure,
right?
But the building was too old to accept it, right? So we created the political will to build a new boys tech. Well, now it's called Bradley Tech.
Right.
But I had to get the community involved as the equal, working in equal rights. And there was a pastor named Roland Womack.
Reverend Roland Womack of Progressive Baptist Church.
Oh, you know him. Well,
I used to be a member of Progressive Baptist Church under Dr. Reverend
come on.
Roland Womack.
Well,
Betty Womack is his lovely bride. Absolutely.
Well, Norquist, the mayor at the time, said he wasn't going to build any more buildings because North Division was sitting there
right.
half empty. And he said, buildings don't educate. But we changed his mind. Once the black ministers got involved, and with that radio station,
right,
they ended up creating a political will that overrode Norquist's will of not to build a brand new tech. But my daughter was a student there, Janie Hatton. You mean
absolutely?
Yeah, Janie was the principal there. So I.
So because again, there's so much. So you've done so much volunteer work. Let's talk about how you wound up doing some of those things that you've done.
Well, when I graduated from law school, a guy named Willie Windham, who was a homeboy from northeastern Louisiana, our families were neighbors. He was working as the district executive for the Milwaukee County Council, Boy Scouts of America. And my scoutmaster had told me when I was 10, 11 years old about paying it forward. And I had a chance to pay it forward when Willie asked me to be the vice president of relationships. And I was that for a little while. And then they asked me to be the district commissioner, responsible for 102 scouting partners, churches and schools that had programs. At the time I took the position, there were no commissioners actively involved in supporting those 102 scouting partners. I recruited 16 commissioners, got them trained, and we took St. Mark had the oldest scouting program in the whole state of Wisconsin, but they were inactive. I found two Eagle Scouts in St. Mark's, got them involved, and then that troop 445 ended up being one of the best troops in the whole state. Got to reactivate it.
So you continued to hold all these various positions that many people would die for, but you know, you didn't put down your roots.
Well, I'm still looking for my grandmother said the Lord got work for you, but I wasn't sure exactly what she meant. And I'm still looking now. I'm still searching. But I think I found it. In fact, I know I found it now.
So what did you find?
Peace, healing, and collaboration. That's who I am.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what that is.
Well, like I told you, we can go back to 2.5 years old, and then when I was 3.5 on the Greyhound bus coming to Milwaukee with my mother, I manipulated her and she started crying. I made my mother cry. That was one of the most devastating, because we were happy to be reunited, right?
Right.
And ever since then, I can't stand to see people cry. And so at Fifth Street School, I was in the office fighting every day, bullies who were picking on my friends because I didn't want to see them cry. And so they made me captain of cadets. I got the certificate now, 1960. But they, you know, back in those days, the captain of the cadets could have, we could report people to the office, break up fights and stuff like that. So that was my first experience intervening in violence.
So you're kind of a violence prevention guru.
Well, I have a lot of experience.
You know, I don't think that there's any human being who's lived an extended period of life that you have who hasn't had some involvement with violence. It's par for the course in the human reality, right?
Right. Well, when I was 8 years old, we were renting from a family. The oldest son, I'm not going to mention his name, but he was a gang leader, right? And being the curious kind of kid I was, I would sneak out the back door with them. And in effect, I'm 8 years old running with a teenage gang, right? But I got scared straight one night because I had an assignment to steal something out of this store on 6th and Center, and I got caught. And it was, the traffic was so bad, I couldn't cross the street, so they came out and apprehended me, took me back in the office at the telephone. I can remember like it was yesterday. Why did you do it? So I blamed it on the big, I said, the big boys made me do it. And then the man said, the woman asked me, why'd you do it? And then the man said, well, if you were on a bridge and they asked you to jump off the bridge, would you do it? So that was a teachable moment for me at 8 years old, because I could see myself on the bridge. And I said, no. And then my grandparents sold the farm, moved north, and then I was in church every Sunday.
So Charles, violence is the order of the day in this society. I don't care what nation or whatever it is, it's a part of the reality of human life. Why?
Well, the human condition, you know, being right, making others wrong, looking good, afraid of looking bad, validating your story and validating others. But the one that has the most weight is domination, avoiding domination. Domination, avoiding domination. Avoiding domination shows up just like domination. But when you feel like there's a threat, sometimes people snap.
So is that domination a human trait? Is that something that's inherent in us, or is that something that's learned?
Very good question. I think it comes out of perceiving a threat. But then you have bullies. I can never understand why somebody would want to be a bully, but maybe bullies feel, maybe they don't see themselves as being a bully. Because the bully I had to fight almost every day at Fifth Street School, he was much bigger than I was. I ended up playing against him in high school football. They didn't even have pads big enough for him. Shoulder pads, he didn't even play with shoulder pads.
So
let me, I had to fight him almost every day.
So let me ask you then, is there a bully in each one of us that we have to control?
Oh man, that's a great question.
You know, and the reason I ask that is because the longer you live this life, the more you look at it and you just see that there are just some things that, you know, that happened in your life, and you look at yourself and you look in the mirror and it's kind of like having to suppress thoughts that we may have. I sometimes wonder, as you know, I'm a guy who, I think I had 2 fights in my entire life. And I wasn't the guy who created them or the guy who pushed them. It was in self-defense. Mm-hmm. And I never understood what people got out of beating up some other human being, right? I never understood that.
You know, I worked in a prison for about 4 years. I commuted to Winnebago County, and a lot of the guys there never took responsibility for what they did. They were always a victim. We had a program. It was a 9-day training program that we took into the largest wall prison in the world, in Jackson State in Michigan. And this program was so powerful that we used the technology of transformation, right? But after the 9-day course, and we did this 3 years straight, they actually took responsibility. Lifers took on responsibility for making, you know, keeping the prison safe and clean. Guys went out and transformed their communities. But it was having them transform where they could perceive themselves as the perpetrator. But as before that, they perceived themselves as a victim.
So does environment produce that you're not born into this world predisposed to be that way? I mean, does environment create that?
I think it does. I think it does. And I think people justify what they're doing out of that victim posture.
But, you know, nations can do the same.
Well, look at
this. We're watching nations right now.
Well, look at Israel.
Yes.
They're being offensive, but, you know, when you hear Netanyahu talks about, like, why they bomb.
Everybody that they're bombing.
They're saying they're doing this because they feel threatened right. by these other countries who aren't doing anything to them.
Right.
But the mindset is, that's what comes over the media. They feel like they have to do this in order to be safe because they feel threatened by these other
destroying other human beings.
I don't understand. Well, I hear what they're saying. I couldn't justify it.
So you are this person who now has dedicated your life to violence prevention. And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I was working part-time. Like I said, after I graduated from law school, I've been teaching as an adjunct professor, constitutional law, violence prevention, race and justice, economic and social change, global economy, culture, and community. And when Springfield College was about to close down, I began to look at, well, if I could teach for Springfield College, I could teach for myself.
Right. So
why don't I find
a niche
lane? Because, you know, I'm 70. I'm already 77 years old.
Right.
77. So I'm looking at, well, what lane could I run in where I could have the most impact? And it came down to non-traditional families. Because there's a direct correlation between parenting, ineffective parenting, and violence. And I could see, because of the mediation work I did in families, when I could get the parents who had been in dispute to see that if you want the qualities and characteristics you say you want in your children, you have to
exhibit them yourself.
You got to model them yourself.
Exactly.
And so I said, well, maybe, you know, we could create an alternative or maybe a support to family court, because it's not a very friendly place for people who look like you and I. So I'm looking at, well, why don't we create an alternative to that system where there's a different agenda, judges, commissioners, the guardian ad litem. Why don't we bring that to the community? We could train people to do conflict coaching and mediation through the churches or community-based organizations that have a peace mission incorporated in their purpose.
So because we're up against time constraints, I want to bring you back and we'll delve deeper into what we're talking about now, because that's a whole different hodgepodge of things that I think people need to hear, because you also throw trauma-informed care into that mix.
That's it.
And so, you know, people don't realize that these things, you wouldn't need to have as many prisons as you have if people understood, right? The Donald Trump and the government is looking to reopen Alcatraz. I mean, just if you think that's the answer, you really have missed the boat. You can build all the prisons and all the things that you want to, but you'll never be able to lock up enough people who have been dealing with trauma. And the answer to the trauma is not lock them up.
We can take responsibility for the healing part. You know, like I said, peace, healing, and collaboration. All of us got trauma. It's handed down epigenetically,
right,
from 7 to 14 generations. So whatever we do, it's got to be intergenerational in order to have the sea change that's necessary. Like Joe Madison, our friend, used to say,
right,
we need, everybody can do something. You know, he used to say that all the time. Everybody can do something. And we played college football together.
Well, you know, Charles, I'm going to bring you back, mm-hmm, and then we'll delve even deeper into this conversation. But the time for now has expired. And I want to thank you, man. And we'll certainly have a part two to this discussion.
Okay.
All right. That's Charles Robinson. And so I can't wait until we do part two. And once again, you've been listening to What's Going On with Earl Ingram.